Well, we're back for a second episode. We made it this far. Yeah. Both sets of our parents said they loved it.
Yeah. That's absolutely right. So by popular demand, episode two.
Here we are. And this week we're going to have a bit of a chat about CBI, 28 billion, Dragon's Den. Just some really interesting stuff to kind of get into. Probably the biggest business political news of the week was the fact that the CBI have settled with the former Director General, Tony Danker. We're not going to get into all of that. But I do think there's an interesting question about what the CBI is for now and what will it be for under a Labour government potentially later in the year.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And you're right. We should absolutely just jump over the legal minefield of various lawsuits that are hanging over the CBI and around. I mean, what a mess that all was. So we don't need to sort of pick over the demise of the CBI, but we should have a bit of a conversation about its kind of re-emergence. Mm-hmm. And I think some businesses that ran away from it last year have come back into the fold, and I think government is starting to take their calls again.
Yeah.
Which is important because the membership of the CBI needs that kind of public voice and private engagement on its behalf. But it does raise the question about what is the CBI going to do now that it's sort of being allowed back into the party. I think it's a really important topic because the membership of the CBI they like to talk a lot about how they have businesses of all sizes and sectors, and that's fine, and it's, you know, it's true. But basically, what I think most people think of them as is the voice of large business.
Yeah.
And that's a really, really important constituency in our national debate, in our economy. And I don't think they should shy away from that.
Yes.
And it feels like the CBI, you know, they're sort of behaving like a think tank. You know, all they want to do is talk about green economy this and, you know, green prosperity that. And there's, you know, there are enough voices on that topic. And actually, I think someone should just be more robust and confident in representing the very kind of real and important interests of the biggest employers, the biggest, whether they are manufacturers, financial services groups, etc. You can't just, you know, pretend that you're just the voice of, you know, sort of entrepreneurship and medium-sized businesses, because A, there are groups who really are the voice of those entities, and B, as I said, big business deserves to have somebody with some confidence and some swagger and some clout representing its interests.
Completely. And I saw that they used to claim they spoke for 190,000 businesses, which I always thought was sort of a bit, you know, you can't claim to speak for that many people of that many different shapes and sizes. Now they say they speak for 170,000. And I just think it's still a little bit, you know, far-fetched to be able to speak for that many people. And it's become very, everyone's in favour of small business, right? And everyone likes startups and entrepreneurs and that side of things. But I do think that big business is lacking a bit of a voice and needs somebody to say that big business is a good thing. And I do think that actually there is an argument to say we're only going to speak for 100 or 1,000. You know, they employ this many million of people, add this much to the economy, rather than trying to sort of do this kind of catch-all element of it, which I just think is quite difficult to do. And particularly as these groups get smaller and get more kind of niche interests, that actually their niche should become big business. I think that would be a better space for them to kind of play in. And it will be really important under a Labour government for big business to have a proper voice at the table.
Yeah, the difficulty that groups like the CBI have, I mean, we experienced it, you know, a little bit during our time at the IOD, where you might want to take an institutional position, which is supported by some members and is less enthusiastically supported by other members, but on the whole, you sort of know the territory you're in. And the CBI, by its nature, will struggle more with that tension, because, for example, you know, they will have major high street retailers on their membership, and they will also have, you know, major digital retailers like Amazon on their membership. And I know the sort of tension that exists between those kind of members when it comes to the CBI taking a view on things like you know, digital transaction taxes or business rates on the high street, etc. There will be a tension between different parts of its membership because its membership is is so big and so diverse, but it has these, you know, huge companies represented, and how they interact with a Labour government, if there is to be one, is really, really interesting question, because we've already seen the CBI has a new president in Rupert Soames, you know, an extremely well-known and experienced business figure from the city. And he, I believe, has recently cautioned Labour about going too far, urging them not to go too far in some of the sort of workers' rights protections that they've been talking about, sort of strengthening employment rights and workers' rights provisions. And the Labour Party have just said, forget it, jog on.
Yeah.
And that's a really stark reminder that if there is to be a Labour government, you know, it will be doing things differently as far as the business community is concerned, and particularly the big business community. You know, people who are perhaps by the nature of the size of their payroll more sensitive to issues around minimum wage or workers' protections and provisions, etc. So that relationship, I mean, not to say that it's off to a rocky start. Of course it's not. This is the job of the CBI, is to speak on behalf of its members. But it seems in round one in public diplomacy with the Labour Party, they've fallen out over this issue already. And so it will be interesting to see how not just the CBI, but all business groups interact with an incoming Labour government. We talked on the first episode about Ian Anderson's review as to how the business community should interact with a Labour government. And yeah, it was quite an interesting report and sort of set of recommendations. There was nothing particularly concrete in it. What it basically seemed to say was the business community would like to have better and more predictable relationships with government than they have had over the last 5 years.
Yeah. Exactly that. Yeah, and Rupert Soames is a very experienced city leader, you know, led Serco for a long time in the UK, and I think, you know, we'll find a way through for it and sort of rebadge the CBI and kind of get it going again, because I do think that business needs to do it.
And the question of how the CBI interacts with the Labour government is actually just part of a bigger question about how is the business community going to get on under a Labour government.
Yeah.
So it's one thing about, you know, your relationship with them and how good and effective your sort of interaction and lobbying is, if you like. But how do you deal with and respond to Labour policies is a different question.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
And that almost neatly brings us on to the 28 billion, which we spoke about last week. And again, quite a lot of...
Hang on a minute. You're not going to leave the sneeze in, are you? Surely that's going to be snipped out.
I think it will be.
Well, no. You know what? This is rough and ready. My kids have both got colds. It's completely inevitable that I'm going to sneeze in the middle of recording these things. We're agreed. The sneeze stays in.
The sneeze stays.
It's authenticity.
Clip that for socials. But the 28 billion is quite interesting. We spoke about that last week, and
Labour's 28 billion pound a year investment in the green economy, which is now 24 billion pounds over 5 years.
Yes, but they've sort of divvied and davered with it all week, and now they've as you say, like basically completely dropped it, right?
Extraordinary, and. I mean, there are all sorts of ways to dissect this story. The first thing that's worth noting is that it was The Sun reported about 3 weeks ago that this was going to happen, that Labour was going to abandon this enormous financial commitment. And the official response to The Sun story from Labour was complete nonsense. And indeed, plenty of other journalists were then a bit sneery and sniffy at this Sun story, taking Labour at their word when they said the story was nonsense. The story was not nonsense. And when, you know, within the last 2 or 3 days, the Labour Party has confirmed that they are going to abandon this totemic commitment, it seems, you've got a question, is this one of those things that goes completely over the heads of the general public? You know, people in general pay a lot less attention to the ins and outs of politics than people like you and people like me tend to assume and think and occasionally hope. And I suppose the question is, Labour Party just said, let's just pull this plaster off, let's get it over with, let's stop having to talk about this before the election campaign really kicks off, before people do start paying more attention, and before the Tory party can devise all sorts of attacks about how this policy commitment of ours might end up, you know, manifesting itself in tax rises or higher borrowing or whatever it might be. They've just said, let's get rid of it. Now, what that means for poor old Ed Miliband, who's basically his only job in the shadow cabinet was to go around and talk about this $28 billion, how they were going to spend it. Actually, that's an interesting question. I'm sure the Labour Party would rather talk about it, and in my view, they should have talked more about why they were going to spend this money. What were they going to spend it on?
Yeah.
Why was it important to do so? Rather than just this figure, which Westminster in particular and people in financial circles became obsessed with, they didn't actually talk a lot about why Labour wants to do this. What's crazy is that Labour, now having ditched this pledge on the altar of financial credibility, and you've talked about how sort of ruthless they are in their pursuit of power, they've ditched this pledge so that they can't be beaten around the head by it. But they have basically still said everything they wanted to spend it on, they're still going to do. Still very important to do it, and all these great green policies are still going to happen, and they're going to have a carbon neutral electricity grid by 2030, etc. I mean, anyone who knows anything about that has said it's for the birds, and that would probably cost about $200 billion.
Yeah.
So they're starting to, I think it's quite clear what they're trying to do is they want to stop talking about $28 billion price tag, and they want to start talking about the policies and the rationale for what they wanted to spend the money on in the first place, even though they're no longer going to spend it.
But there's lots of different types of credibility. And I think it's interesting because they've said that we're not having it because the financial situation has changed, etc., from when we originally announced the policy. But actually, the financial situation is better than when the policy was first announced 9 months ago. There's more fiscal headroom. And yeah, they were getting called out by Paul Johnson of the IFS on this. And you just think, well, actually, it's all very well sort of being completely ruthless for power. But you have got to have some things. You have got to get your party marshalled and excited about what they're actually doing and what they're going to do. And at the moment, it comes back to this point that we keep saying of no one really seems to know what Labour's going to do. And it's fine to shrink the target and all of that we talked about in the first episode. But actually, you have got to go to the country with, like, this is how it's going to be different. This is how it's going to be better. It's not just enough to say, we're not these guys. Like, you will have to find something to get people excited about. And at the moment, they just don't have that.
And you can't really overstate the extent to which the Labour Party and its various kind of affiliate groups and different wings have torn themselves to pieces internally over this $28 billion. Because for some people like Rachel Reeves and one assumes now Keir Starmer, it was just a question of financial credibility, and they don't want to be beaten with it in the election campaign, and they don't want to be accused of being reckless with public finances. There are a huge number of other voices in the Labour Party and the wider Labour movement for whom this wasn't just a question of financial credibility or even viability. It was a major, almost sort of philosophical commitment and a project and a sort of a statement of the state's capabilities and what a Labour-run government would do and believes in. They get all very excited about the amount of money that Joe Biden has pumped into the US economy, and lots of people on the left over here think that the government should be doing something similar, and the $28 billion per year that Labour had said they would spend was seen as a part of that and on the same sort of ideological spectrum of that sort of public sector investment in the economy, very much in the kind of Gordon Brown school of thought. Mm. And so for lots of people, this is just a question of let's stop saying $28 billion because, it might embarrass us. And for lots of other people in the Labour Party, it wasn't just about that. It was about the kind of government we're going to be, the kind of country we want to have. Personally, I think people can overstate the wisdom or the benefits of state expenditure as a sort of try and pump the real economy, like. But that's a philosophical debate for another day. But in the Labour Party, it's a huge argument that it does not end with Rachel Reeves saying we're no longer going to commit to $28 billion because we can't afford it.
Yeah, exactly that. And speaking of businesses, sort of wider representation in the public, as we've touched on a bit there, I also wanted to talk a bit about Dragon's Den. And I thought it was very interesting. We had Superbooks on the podcast last week, and they were on Dragon's Den as well. And for those of you that haven't seen the episode, Superbooks went on and said to the Dragons, we want 1% for £1. It's the first time anyone's ever done that on Dragon's Den. I am an investor in Superbooks, one of the 29 angels that they mentioned. Weirdly, I didn't get a name check, and they went with Tom Blomfield and Princess Beatrice on the on the show. I'm probably third, I imagine.
Fun shareholder meeting, though.
Yeah, exactly. And it was just quite interesting because, yeah, there's two big business shows in the UK in terms of popular culture. It's The Apprentice and Dragon's Den. And there were a few remarks online sort of saying, well, you know, is this really a business show anymore if people are just going on there asking for a pound, etc.? And, you know, Dragon's Den's never created any unicorns, etc. And I was like, I don't think... Somebody said Dragon's Den hasn't even made half a unicorn. I was like, I don't actually think they've even made 5% of a unicorn, right? A 50 million valuation. But I just think it's really interesting to get people's perception on how businesses run. And I still think it's a great show, Dragon's Den. And I actually still, it's always been in that kind of edutainment space. And I think it's great that Superbooks kind of went on there. And it is probably most people's first introduction to business, really.
I know you love Dragon's Den. And my wife loves Dragon's Den. I don't really like it. I find it quite annoying and quite sort of, you know, overly curated these days,
yeah.
Compared to what it was back in the day, if you like. And back in the day, I feel it was slightly more authentic. I feel there were genuine cases of people coming in and saying, listen, I want this much money so that I can build this and I want to sell it for X. And
yeah.
you had dragons that would sit there and say, you're out of your mind, get out. And you had others who would argue about the stake they wanted, but they would put the money in. And you get a bit of that in the sort of more recent series, but it's very different. You know, you get a lot more, you know, people's backstories and waterworks and the sob stories and, you know.
Reality TV.
It's a much more kind of reality TV vibe to it. And they love all that. And, you know, part of that is because of, look, you know, the dragons themselves have changed.
Yeah.
And that's, by the way, you know, somebody could, I'm sure, write an interesting essay on how long has Dragon's Den been going on for now? 20 years?
20 years,
right,
yeah.
So you could look at the changing nature of the dragons and what does it tell us about the changing nature of the economy? Yes. Because, you know, you used to have sort of, you know, retailers and manufacturers and private equity dragons, and now you've got kind of social media influencers and ex-footballers cropping up as dragons. So it has changed. It's definitely changed. But you mentioned that Superbooks as a particular example. And I think that's really interesting. They were honest enough to say, we don't actually want your money. We actually just want, you know, we want your basically PR support from you, if I read it right, and your endorsement and your commitment to our project and our values, which we feel are really important. Now, that was very honest. And I think, you know, there are plenty of people who go in Dragon's Den who are not as honest, who basically want to be on TV and would love it if Stephen Bartlett could, you know, Instagram them off the back of it. That would do for them. That's the investment they want. And so to me, I find it slightly twee on occasion and slightly annoying.
I think, I think that's all fair. And I think it is a very interesting example of how the kind of economy is changing. I also think it's partly the way that the investor landscape is changing. Because actually, yeah, there's been 22 seasons of Dragon's Den now. So when the first ones come out, it just at the sort of start of the millennium, you know, the internet was only just really getting going. Like, actually, if you wanted business investment and you didn't know anyone, it really was your kind of like perhaps your one shot. Whereas now you can go and sort of Google lots of people. And actually, the story of how Superbooks got their initial angel investment is a great one. They just sent a cold LinkedIn message to our good pal Henry Desope, who then sort of took them on this kind of journey. And obviously, Henry, former special advisor to Michael Gove, but also went on to start a company that got a very high valuation on Dragon's Den and exited it as well. And so, it's
yeah,
just...
that was a really good example.
Yeah.
It was a proper pitch with a proper business that needed some proper money, which then went on to do very well.
Yeah.
And Henry's done very well, deservedly so.
Yeah.
And I'd just like to see more of that on Dragon's Den.
Yeah, and I think that's...
And what about the argument now that you hear about that this sort of fakery rows and it's not as real as it seems, and you know they've got an army of producers who go out and try and find people and convince them to be on the show.
Yes.
You know, I'm sure of course there's always going to be a degree of that, but it feels like the sort of... There was one particular episode recently, wasn't there, that caused some controversy of somebody, you know, claiming sort of medical benefits to a an earring or something. And everybody, all the dragons loved it, and they all tried to, and they all wanted to invest in it. And of course, that itself was cut up by the producers and put out as a news story and social media content, and it backfired because then you had, you know, people who actually know what they're talking about saying, well, that was deeply irresponsible. And off the back of that, you know, people started to cook up stories about how the show isn't as real as it seems. And blah, blah, blah. So it feels like, you know, people are starting to pull at the threads of it a little bit.
I don't actually think getting Gary Neville on worked that well a couple of weeks ago. I just sort of thought, this is getting tweet. And you're right, I'm a massive fan of the show, but it all sort of became about, yeah, it just sort of, it became too kind of emotive, I think, and so on. And I just think...
I get that from the repair shop. I don't, which I do love. I really love. I don't need it from Dragon's Den.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it'll be interesting to see where it goes in terms of the longer term, because I can totally see how you could do kind of a spin-off show now on YouTube, for example, or something like that. I think there's quite a lot of kind of creativity there, because they have got in quite a bit of hot water about that one particular company. They've had to take down the episode, etc.
There are still some great episodes out there, and I think I'm going to get this right when I say that the earliest founder of the original incarnation of, was it Just Eat? I think it was Just Eat, went on an early Dragon's Den with this idea of a website that sort of hosted loads of different fast food restaurants and you know, thinks it's going to be the future of how people order food. And basically, one by one, every dragon just said, this is rubbish. That's never going to work. Why, you know, I know the phone number of the rest of my local Chinese. Why on earth would I need to go through your website? This is crazy. And they all threw him out of the den. Whether the guy in question is anything to do with Just Eat as it is now, I don't know. But as an original idea, it's quite nice to see when the dragons get it so wrong.
Well, there were a few. Of course, there's a Tangled Trees, wasn't there? And there was the wine in a cup to be sold in the supermarket as well, which was completely derided, which, yeah, now is a
staple of every train ride.
Yeah, exactly. Morning commute.
What about the other business show? You mentioned The Apprentice.
Oh, okay. Now,
you don't feel as warm to The Apprentice as you do Dragon's Den.
No, I don't, because I think it really is the sort of worst example of business and what the worst caricature, sort of leaning across a table, shouting at people that they're fired. I just think it's just a terrible depiction of it. And
when you fire people, do you just whisper it?
Yeah, exactly. To say, look, it's over. Just try and get it, move it on. But I find it quite, it's just so aggressive, I find. And obviously it's kind of made for TV, but I don't even think it's that good a TV, really, to be honest. And I just think it shows business in a really poor light. I mean, I saw the Lego Movie the other day, and the bad guy in the Lego Movie is called Lord Business. And for somebody that works between business and politics, this is pretty
sad. And who loves Lego.
I just found it really...
It's a great film, though. It's a fabulous film. We will come back to talk about The Apprentice, but you're right, the Lego Movie is great. But the villain in it is Mr. Business, who's got, you know, evil plans. And that is very often the case. And our friend Matthew Elliott, now Lord Elliott, gave a really thoughtful speech a couple of months ago where he launched his new project, the Jobs Foundation, which I would recommend to everybody, because apart from anything else, it wants to make a positive case for business of all sizes, and employment and jobs in particular, a very, very positive case for them. And so he launched by giving a really thoughtful speech that took apart precisely the issue you've just raised about how is business represented in films and in popular culture, and why are they portrayed as the villains, or, you know, whose motivations are always to be questioned, and whose contribution to society is you know, is not positive. And there are many cases, and in fact, I think, you know, huge amount of academic research, particularly in the US, has looked at this very question. And Matthew's speech was a really good counter argument to that. But The Apprentice is an example that does play into that narrative, and because it is just a ridiculous program full of Love Island rejects, and the original premise I thought was quite good. People want a job; it's a well-paid job, and we're going to make you jump through all these ridiculous hoops to get it. appreciate the format's changed now. It's more about who gets investment for their business. It's my biggest bugbear with The Apprentice is the fact that it's not until, I mean, as far as the viewing public is concerned, and you get the impression that it's the case for Alan Sugar and others, is it's not until he's whittled all these halfwits down to two or three that he then asks them what their business idea is.
Yeah, exactly.
That he's going to invest in. And, you know, some of them have done quite well. Most of them are absolute, you know, pile of rubbish. But it's so manufactured and it's such nonsense. Imagine going for a job interview and, you know, and somebody says, yeah, you're quite a credible candidate. What I want you to do, though, for me is to go away and I'll give you a day and a half and I want you to devise and film an advert for a new kind of dog food. And you go, what? What's that got to do with the job I'm applying for? And he goes, well, just do it. And you think, okay, I don't think I want this job.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Or go and see how many chicken sandwiches you can sell at Borough Market or whatever. Yeah. Like, it just, yeah, it drives me slightly crackers. And I just think there must be a better way of doing kind of a mainstream sort of business show, because I think some of it is interesting. And actually the challenges are a bit better. What really irritates me is just quite how long they spent in the boardroom sort of like tearing strips off everyone about stuff. And actually some of the challenges are sort of like moderately interesting and quite an innovative way of pulling business together, I think, and like what goes into branding, etc., etc. But yeah, I feel it's a show that could really do with being updated.
I'll tell you a good show that shines a really interesting light on business. I don't think it means to. I'm not sure anyone thinks about it in this way. But if you watch Inside the Factory,
yes,
with Greg Wallace.
Yes.
You know, that is not presented as making the case for business. But whether it intends to or not, it makes the case for incredibly efficient manufacturing, supply chains, innovation, keeping your costs down, your logistics, your distribution, whatever particular episode it is, whether the factory in question is making jeans or M&Ms, it's an extraordinary showcase of very often the most efficient kind of pinnacle of manufacturing, which is a huge part of our economy. So I think inadvertently shows like that can be really interesting. And I don't think it would ever occur to Greg Wallace or any of the producers to talk about the sort of, you know, hidden hand and the sort of, you know, great economic forces that have enabled these factories to do what they do. But because I'm a bit weird, that's what I think when I watch it.
Yeah, that's exactly where my mind goes with this stuff as well. There's quite a good show on Channel 5 recently as well, a three-part series into Greggs. And I just found it fascinating about how that has become... Yeah, how they basically scaled the business. You know,
yeah,
I was sitting there thinking, gosh, it's really interesting to scale up.
And actually, you're right. So it's always around Christmas time. You know, there'll be an ITV show like Inside Tesco's or Inside Lidl or something, and it shows you. Again, these are incredibly well-run businesses. Yeah. I mean, phenomenally well-run businesses. And I did quite a lot of work for or with Tesco's leadership for a couple of years in my most recent job. And I got to know them very well. And
the margins are tight, right?
Oh, it's extraordinary. But the thing that stood out for me was that, I'll never forget the chief executive, Ken Murphy of Tesco, explaining that the busiest day of any retailer's year is always 23rd of December. And they know that, food retailers I'm talking about. And they know that, obviously, and they start planning for it in August. And in the earliest days of the pandemic, Tesco, not just Tesco, pretty much every food retailer in the country, Tesco had about seven consecutive 23rd of Decembers for which they were not prepared. And they didn't run out of anything. And the logistics around the sort of food delivery infrastructure in this country is absolutely mind-blowing. That is a topic for another day. We should look into that. We should actually do an episode around looking, you know, pick a particular business and really examine it and start to look at under the bonnet. You know, I mean, how many people know that Tesco basically has its own railway lines and its own trains that is responsible for an enormous amount of the delivery of food around this country? But you don't see them because they don't pull up at passenger stations. Okay, I can talk a lot about Tesco. We'll do it another day.
We can, but that makes me think of getting someone from head of logistics on Jimmy's Jobs or something. I mean, we had the founders of the Club Card, Edwina and Clive, come on Jimmy's Jobs last year, and it was fascinating listening to how they basically implemented data. And that's what made Tesco get so far ahead of the curve so quickly in that sort of dramatic scaling phase of the 90s and noughties. Amazing episode. Well, that probably calls to an end this week. Interesting couple of things coming up. We've got a live show of Jimmy's Jobs with Harry Cole and James Heal. Tickets have sold out, so I'm not giving it any promo on that sense. And PM's Business Council is meeting on Valentine's Day. So what headline would you have written for that?
Well, I mean, I look forward to headline-wise is always like things happening around Valentine's Day or Halloween. And is there going to be an election around Halloween? That writes itself. And as for Valentine's Day, what you'd like is for the business leaders in question to emerge from the meeting and brief the media that it was a complete waste of everyone's time, and then you can write about Valentine's Day massacre and all that, etc. So, okay, we'll try and get some eyes and ears inside that meeting, shall we? That's the challenge we've set ourselves.
Exactly.
And when we fail, we'll just read Mark Kleiman.
Yeah, exactly. Mark will be in there. Mark Woods. That was one of my tests in number 10 was like, is this going to get to Kleiman and how quickly if we were working through something? But yeah, a heck of a journalist. Thanks for listening. See you next week. We'll see you in the future.
Do you want to say it normally?